Monday, March 21st, 2005. We have agency priority discussions today, although it says SB 5509 and SB 5510 on the agenda. We will only be doing SB 5509 today. So I will open a public hearing on 5509 so we know that it's under consideration. You were all given some homework for over the weekend and two copies of a master list for all the major education agencies before the committee. We need to get that list back from you, if not this morning, later today, your extra copy. We are going to spend today just on the Oregon Department of Education.
That's Senator Winsett.
Oh, okay. At least I only need one of them. So.
What do we do with the other one?
You keep it. Just in case.
I thought when I went to their big committee.
Oh, no. They just go to... Just to Sue here. In doing this, this is kind of experimental because I think this is the first time this has been done in an open committee. And one of the things I think that is going to be important to do is to, one, get a brief explanation of each item that's in this, particularly those where there might be some concerns about what's included in that item. And then we will attempt from the discussion to set some sort of priority ranking, probably after the discussion, and bring it back to you tomorrow morning. I would say in that priority ranking that I would not be too concerned if an item that you had ranked fourth or fifth was ranked seventh or eighth. I might be concerned if an item you'd rank fourth or fifth was 18th or 20th, because I don't think that the rankings, one or two difference, is going to make a big difference in the overall way this is considered. So with that, I will turn it over to Sue to give a brief explanation, and we should have some materials also from the Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. I did pass out this morning an updated list for you. The department, when it was first here for its phase one hearings, had changed a couple of the numbers on the list. On your second page, on accountability and leadership, those numbers were slightly revised, and so probably the list that you got last week, you'll see some different numbers, but they're not big differences, but I did just want to draw your attention to that.
Accountability and
leadership.
Okay.
So what I thought I'd do today, especially for the benefit of the subcommittee members who haven't been on the education subcommittee prior to discussion, is just give you a brief description of each item that's on this list to the best of my ability, and we may need to get the department up here to provide more information if you have detailed questions. So the first item that you see on the list is the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program. I think most of you are familiar with that. It's a program, an early education program, and it serves kids 3 and 4 year olds.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm having difficulty hearing.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Oh, he's just having difficulty hearing, so if you'll speak up.
These programs are designed to foster the development of the students and enhance their success when they get into school. And most of the programs, as I understand it, in Oregon are blended with the federal Head Start program. And one thing I'd like to point out about this program is that the statutes required that 50% of the eligible children be served by 1999 and 100% by 2004. And this biennium, I think around 59% are being served. And in the governor's budget, that funding level will cause that percent to drop down to about 53%. So the department has ranked this program its number one priority department-wide, I believe, for the reasons that early childhood programs are important to the department. One of the superintendent's initiatives, and the program already has taken a pretty big hit.
Yes. Mr. Chair, if this would be a time to get clarifications from the department.
Yes.
Okay. The program is ranked number one, but as I understand it, the program was submitted to the governor as a cut. Can we reconcile?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bordley, certainly we can invite the department to come up and address that. I believe one of the reasons is because in the grant-made programs that the department has, there are very few that can be cut below a certain level because of maintenance of effort requirements by the federal government. And so the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten program typically is first up when we're looking for large reductions because it does not have a maintenance of effort requirement like the special education programs do. But certainly we can invite the department to come up and provide you more detail on that and how they came to that decision.
A little bit more information would be helpful for the record. Not a maintenance of effort requirement, but a statutory requirement to serve all eligibles by 2004.
Right. Okay.
A brief comment would help, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West, Assistant Superintendent for Department of Education. The way that Sue characterized that was correct, because we had to make 10% reduction option proposals to the governor's budget. We did it on a budget category by category basis. And in the grant and aid program, where the OPK program, early intervention, early childhood, and some of those other programs are, we did run into those federal maintenance of effort issues so that we could not recommend a reduction in any other program. We began with some other programs first, student leadership centers, Frontier Learning Network, and the OPEN project. But to get to the 10% option, all we had left was OPK. So we would rather not have done that, but it was part of the budget instructions that we had to follow.
Thank you.
Would you characterize that as much? Well, it is actually the same as the exercise. There's two exercises in this: the budget reductions you had to offer to the governor as potential budget reductions, and then the budget reductions you have to offer in the Ways and Means process as part of our process. They're similar in nature. It's just the governor took one of yours.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. At least one.
Yes. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are we going to... We're just talking... percentage enrolled people is not a performance measure. If that's what we're going to be looking at this, is that what we're going to evaluate this $43 million on?
I think we are going to reference at times performance measures... but I think we're probably not going to tie performance measures in an open discussion to each and every one of these 20-some items, or there's no way we will get through this. I think that the performance measure that's actually most relevant to this, but I don't know its specific tie into this program, is the percentage of children entering school that are ready to learn, which is probably the not simply the number of percentage attending. So okay, you want to give an explanation of the
sure.
next
If I could just follow up on that comment, Mr. Chair, I wasn't planning on pointing out any of the performance measures, as you said. Not really making any. I don't have to make any decisions this week on making that connection. You can, of course, consider performance measures in your discussion. But I do want to remind you that the department is undergoing the process of revising a lot of their performance measures. So some of which you see in their reports
right.
will either be deleted or modified. This particular one does have performance measures, and as you pointed out, there's one with a percentage of children entering school ready to learn. There's also a percentage of enrolled that complete the program, and then the percentage of enrolled. So there are three performance measures.
Thank you. You'll have to project a little bit more this morning. I'm sorry.
You want to go on to the next item?
Sure. The next item is the early...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Did you have a question?
Yes, Representative Jensen.
I have a question about the department, and I was reviewing material over the weekend, trying to catch up on this section when I just came in, but the department's revising of the performance measures. And I have some real problem and real difficulty with this. Not they maybe need to revise them, but for heaven's sake, if the Department of Education can't write meaningful performance measures, what's this telling me? You know, I mean, I'm astounded at the fact that they've had these performance measures assigned from a previous legislature, and we get to this point, you know, 2 years later, and find that there are too many. And too vague or ambiguous to be meaningful, and therefore we kind of don't want to be evaluated on them because we're writing new performance measures. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but it's difficult for me to understand, for me to accept this, I guess.
Maybe I can get Ms. Fleming to comment. I should also comment that my understanding is that they have been instructed by the co-chairs to review their performance measures and to come in with performance measures that are probably fewer and more clear, and they're in a process of doing that, and the deadline for that process is about 10 days from today, a week from today. And that they are also going to be including performance measures, which they haven't in the past, for the state school fund.
Yes. Chair Devlin, for the record, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent, the Oregon Department of Education. In our Phase 1 presentation, you will recall that we went through a great deal of information about measuring performance in the system, in an entire workbook that's included in your notebook about student achievement data and a variety of other data points that inform whether or not the educational enterprise is achieving the kinds of outcomes that you would expect. I hope you would also recall that we explained that when we started our reorganization process 2 years ago, the department did not have any performance measures. We established a set of performance measures, then we reorganized, and we indicated at that point in time during the last legislative session that we would be coming back to you with performance measures that were truly more accurately designed to measure the agency's effectiveness. And that is what we will be prepared to share with you in the Phase 2 presentation. In fact, Representative Wisnett's comment about measuring inputs is not a terribly effective way to say whether or not the program and investment is getting you the bang for the buck that you're requiring. We have been in the process of interviewing our stakeholders, interviewing agency employees, and really designing performance measures that have meaning and relevance to you. So it was not an intent to dodge or get around being accountable, but in fact not to be measuring things that don't make a difference, that don't matter.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Whitson.
I would join in Representative Jensen's concern there. I am. It seems to me that we're being told that we have to equate future potential performance outcomes with future potential spending. I mean, we're equating the performance with the amount of money we can spend on it. And, you know, we all know that we've got a flat revenue stream. Well, funding available to an agency is a measure of the performance and outcome potential, it is certainly not the only, and arguably not even the most important, measure of performance potential. I think that we should be looking to hear some answers to questions like, how will you maintain or improve your level of service and outcome potential in light of our state's relatively flat revenue stream? How will you change your management and prioritize your agency's personnel to achieve expected outcomes without significant increases in revenue? In short, how will you restructure your service delivery system to deal with the current reality, which is a flat revenue stream?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Before I speak, Senator, were you expecting a response or a comment to...
Senator, it was an editorialization.
All right. I don't want to jump in if you're not finished. I think it's important that we recognize a couple of things here. One, when the superintendent inherited the Department of Education, inherited, if you will, she inherited an agency that had no performance measures, And so what we have now is a work in progress. And it's a work in progress that is being informed by a new process that is being developed by this legislature through its ways and means process in this session. And so we all need to be mindful of where we're starting from and be flexible in our understanding of where we started from and in our understanding that it is a work in process, in progress, and the department, in my view, has gone back and they're doing the work that we asked them to do, which is to further refine the performance measures that they presented to us in phase one. So I think that if anything, we want to provide constructive criticism, but I think criticism of where they are at this point, it would be unfair.
If you would want to briefly comment, and then we should probably get back on schedule.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, thank you very much for that recognition of the fact that this is very much a work in progress. And in our description in phase one of the agency, we described the agency as one being in transition. This year, for the first time, we are collecting data from school districts at the student level rather than aggregated data by school and district. That requires a great deal of additional work internally, and it requires the agency to continue to transition its skill set. And I think that's a great example of why we need performance measures that are really more clear about what the agency's work is and what the agency does that affects or supports district level outcomes. And to Senator Wisnant's, pardon me, Senator Whitsett's question about how we will revise the service delivery system, I hope that we get an opportunity to talk about that relative to our conversations in Senator Walker's work group about education service districts, because I think that has a great deal of bearing on whether or not the agency, the Department of Education, can get its work done better in support of district outcomes. So I hope we have the invitation to do that at some point.
Chair, well, can I make one comment?
Yes.
Thank you. It's certainly not my comment. We're certainly not predicated on the assumption that I believe that performance measures once written are cast in stone. I believe they should be fluid, and we should be learning from our past successes and failures. However, I would still like to have vague and ambiguous, maybe they were too many of them, maybe they were, maybe there were, but I would still like to have evaluated the process based on what those performance measures were, understanding that we will have an update and we will proceed on from that particular point. By doing so, we might have had a good opportunity to be a partner with the department in their revisions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, what I'll do as we proceed is just briefly give you a description of the performance measures that are listed here on the priority list. And certainly, you know, there's nothing in this process that would preclude the subcommittee members from asking about outcomes, whether there actually is a performance measure for the program. Shouldn't, you know, keep you from asking about what are the outcomes of the program and how does this meet the needs of Oregonians and should it be a high priority. So I would just encourage the subcommittee to ask those kinds of questions and not let the either the lack of a performance measure or not a, you know, a well-worded performance measure keep you from having that discussion.
I had a question also. Ms. Fleming, I asked last week that the department provide a brief explanation of some of the major component areas of your budget that I felt that there was some degree of ambiguity in terms of the committee. And I'd asked for that to be ready today. Do you have it?
Senator Devlin, yes, I believe that Sue has a copy of
A rough draft
that we were intending to put before you to see if it was adequate to meet your needs that we'd be ready to talk about in phase two. We can certainly copy that for the committee.
Yeah. I think it's probably important that they have that, actually, because we're at a point where we need to make some deliberations. Without that before us, we may have some difficulty. So,
very good.
Yeah, we take a moment here.
Senator Devlin, I believe as we spoke last Friday, our intention in phase two is to give you a presentation that takes, as to your question about the lack of understanding of what the agency does, to take a school district and provide in context to you a presentation of what each of the offices at the Department of Education does in support of those district efforts or the transactions that happen between the department and the local district. So I think a lot of that will be answered again in the detailed presentation in phase two as well if it's not answered now.
Okay. Well, Sue is getting this item.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could you clarify for me what we're looking at here? Because, you know, we did our homework, and so now we got a list. This is the list that the department has given us, and it's prioritized from 1 to 20, and it starts over at 1 to... I don't understand.
It's actually...
It goes all the way to 32, is that correct?
That's correct. And that's because we are doing the department today. Tomorrow we will do the state school fund, and they rank the entire state school fund as one. So everything else is a one, but we're actually just dealing with the Department of Ed today. One of the items I might mention is that we do still need to get the list. Many of you have turned in the list, but we still need to get the list back from those of you that have not, because they will give some guidance to Sue in trying to determine some priority listing to give to the chair for these items. I think one of the ways we may be able to proceed now, because I think if we try to get into a discussion of each single item in this list, we're not going to get very far today, is to go through each item and ask, and don't hesitate to ask. Ask if there is any need for any clarification on what that area is, or if you would like to comment on it. So, we had left off, we had actually just gotten through pre-K. So,
ready to learn.
Can we go down item by item here? Are there any questions about the early intervention, early childhood program, or any comments? The 4 and 5, the educating children with disabilities in regional programs and hospital programs.
Just get an update on what that is?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, was it regional programs?
For both.
The regional programs are those programs that are primarily run by the ESDs, and they provide educational support to children who have certain disabilities, such as hearing impairments and vision impairments, autism, severe orthopedic impairments, and deaf blindness. And I think there are 8 regional contact boards at this time, and they hire the trained and certified staff to provide the services, because usually the school districts don't have the economies of scale to do that.
And I was listening to, Mr. Chair, I was listening to one of the meetings that I missed on the state school fund this morning in the car on the way up. And my understanding from Mr. Reeder's testimony was that there's been a 300% increase in these special needs kids, which, and there are high needs kids like those with autism. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I would ask, I had not heard that piece of data, so I would ask Mr. Reeder to address that. You know, there has been significant growth in the area of kids being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder.
Senator Devlin, Senator Walker, I invited Nancy Latini, our superintendent in student learning and partnerships, who manages those programs, to answer that question.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini. The question about autism and the rising numbers came up real early on in the session as well, and we had a conversation about that. I think within the last 10 years it went from something like 300 kids to about 3,000 kids. Mm-hmm. Nationally that's true as well. And what's happened is in the early ages, stages of autism and what we even knew about it, we weren't identifying the kids in the right way. We had a very narrow area of what we looked at, and it was mostly the severe youngsters. What we've learned over time as the diagnosis got better is we were also able to look at other kids who might have been funny-looking kids or called emotionally disturbed or speech and language, who really were falling under the autism spectrum disorder, like Asperger's, high-functioning kids who probably can go off and be independent and even go to college, but needed some direct instruction and would fall under that category. So really the better identification of students is leading us to a better way of serving those kids as well. They probably would have fallen under some other category and not been well served, and now they're being under a category where they are served with the techniques that are very different and very unique to them. And again, the reason why it stays under regional.
And Mr. Reeder, I was correct in my numbers that you had.
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, Brian Reeder with Department of Ed. I believe you are correct. I don't have those numbers with me, but your earlier presentation, I provided growth in special education students by category of disability over the last roughly 10 to 12 years. And the growth in one of the highest growth areas was in autism. I don't recall if 300% is the exact number, but it was, I think, believe in that range, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think that was right. And Mr. Chair, could I ask then, this is, and you had asked a question of Mr. Reeder at that time, whether we had any federal money for special needs, because we're only reimbursing at 11%, and the average district has 13% special needs kids. And the answer was, yes, there was some. So my question is this dollar amount here only state money?
It depends on the... Would it depend on the program?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, what you see in front of you is just the general fund and lottery fund. So this spreadsheet does not reflect the federal funds for that program.
The only place that would reflect just not... They had to put as much as they could on a single spreadsheet.
Right.
So when you see general fund, lottery fund, and you see total funds, and you see a great discrepancy between the general funds, lottery funds, and the total funds, that discrepancy would either be other funds or it would be federal funds.
Federal funds. So this shows 30 million general fund and 41 million total. So that difference then would be the federal funds, most likely.
10.7.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And the priority sheets that you looked at several weeks ago when the department did its presentation, those sheets have all the pieces, so if you still have that, it will show you there is a federal funds for the regional program. The sheet that I have shows that there's about $10.7 million for those programs in federal funds for 0507.
Okay, so then, Mr. Chair, if I could continue. The regional programs are administered through the ESD, and then the hospital programs, I'm not clear.
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, my understanding is that those are also provided either by ESDs or school districts, and those are for education services to kids who are in, they're both hospital programs and then the long-term care and treatment programs.
Okay.
And the kids in the hospitals usually have things like burns, head injuries, other acute or chronic medical conditions, and obviously they can't attend school, so the services are provided to them in the hospital.
Okay.
Would those same comments relate to the long-term care? I would guess they would also.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I did want to point out for those four programs, for EI, ECSE, and regional programs, hospital programs, and long-term care and treatment programs, those are programs for which the spending is used by the department to calculate whether or not they're meeting federal maintenance of effort requirements. And in the governor's budget development process, there were some funds that were taken out of those programs to have a balanced budget, but at the same time it was determined that the maintenance of effort requirements would be met, but at this point it does not appear that any more money could be reduced from those programs without violating those federal requirements. So I believe that's one of the reasons why the department ranked these where they did. And in particular for the EIECSE program, because it's an early childhood education program, I believe that's why it's up there high on the agency's priority list.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I might comment on for the committee is different departments that you will see have made different sort of broad choices in terms of how they list priorities, and I know they must have went through lengthy discussions of how to do that. So I think in this case, this department listed several programs that are in terms of direct service to children in need that have probably a state source and a federal source. And then they chose to list literally all of their federal programs that are largely all federal, and then went into their programs. And that's this is this debate we had with the co-chairs and with the subcommittee chairs, is whether to list priorities for both general fund programs and all federal programs. And it was basically settled that we would list priorities for everything, with maybe a couple of tiny exceptions. And one of those I might comment on is that many budgets have listed debt service if it is a debt that is already, in a sense, encumbered, in the sense that they're already paying on securities that have been issued and the decisions were made long ago. as being, you know, listed as one of the highest priorities, because it's something you can't really decide not to do. The other is whether to list DASH charges, Department of Administrative Service charges. I'd just like to get a general feeling from the committee if they would be okay with basically where a debt has already been incurred and we are paying it and we are obligated to pay it, that that's being listed as a high priority.
Mm-hmm.
DAS charges, Department of Administrative Service charges, I don't think we should list at all, because they're undetermined. Other committees are supposed to determine to what degree they are the appropriate charges. The General Government Subcommittee is the one that has that purview. So I'm just trying to get a general feel from the committee if they would be if that would be acceptable to them in terms of listing them.
Mm-hmm.
Rent will probably make a decision on somewhere in between. For all the going down from all the way from 7 to 20, all the well, actually maybe 7 to, I guess, 18. Well, approximately there, they're almost all federal funds except for the child nutrition, which has about $50,000 in state funds, which I believe is probably the summer lunch program where we made the general fund. Do people feel like they need some explanations on some of these items or would like to comment on some of them?
I'd like to go back to the early intervention, early childhood.
Yeah.
I understand that with the governor's cut, that kept us at maintenance of effort, kept us at that level. But what did that do to the percentage of what's the impact in terms of the percent of eligibles who will not be served?
This is the 0 to 2 program, right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, this program is a special education program, so the kids who are eligible are served, and that's why there has been such a large increase since the early 90s in this program. The annual growth in the caseload historically has been about 5 to 6%. In 2002-03, it slowed to about 2%, I believe, and then there was one year where there was actually some case decline. I'm not sure if the department at this point has determined what that was, but it looks like growth is recurring, and the governor's budget actually assumes 2% per year, so caseload growth is accommodated, even though there's an adjustment in overall funding.
So that every eligible child,
that's my understanding,
will be served.
Absolutely, yes, and we are increasing. You're correct, sir.
A general question about this program as it relates to pre-K. Every eligible child will be served in this program. How many of those children would normally fit the requirements if we had the funding for pre-K? Because if we have every child served in this program and we're serving about 59 and potentially dropping to 53 in pre-K, what does that mean?
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, the Oregon Head Start pre-kindergarten program requires every program to save 10% of their slots for students with disabilities. And statewide right now, we're at about an average of 16% of the kids served in Oregon preschool Head Start programs are students with disabilities at the 3- and 4-year-old level. We could make a guess that there would be more. It's hard to say.
Okay. I know that I don't have the numbers right before me, but the pre-kindergarten program total eligibles is about 11,000 statewide, or
close to 9. Yes, for Oregon pre-K Head Start,
or for pre-K.
For pre-K, yes, about 11. You're right.
About 11. And how many are early intervention, early childhood special education programs?
The December 1 count of 2004, we had 7,770 students birth through 4, up to 5.
Okay. And so, just my rough math, that's a relatively high cost per student going through the program.
Yes, it is. These are, most of all, you can guess, with young children there, you're going to identify the severe needs of kids, not the kids with learning disabilities, but some of the younger kids who need some of the access to therapies.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Ms. Kevlo, on your, are we back on 7 through 18? Or what?
Yes, yes.
Okay. I was, at some point, it seemed like previous testimony was that the federal funds were enhancement. They were not a standalone programs, but it looked like these are all standalone programs. Is there? Am I on the right track with all that?
I guess the question to that would be, A, they're all federally funded, or there could be other funds. We just don't show other funds, but I'm assuming that they're mostly all federally funded. How many of them are choices? I mean, just that's not a very nice way to make it, but how many of them are actually, are any of them, do we have a choice, or is it, and I'm not saying they're not good choices, I'm just saying, is the state required to basically administer these programs?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Brett West, most of these programs we could probably say no to if we really wanted to. That would mean a loss of about almost $800 million to the education system over the next biennium.
I don't think anyone's advocating that. I'm just...
And Mr. Chair, in response to Senator Nelson's question, these are in addition to the basic services that are provided through the state funds that are distributed to the distribution formula for very special purposes. I think that was the question you were asking. So for things like Title I or child nutrition programs, pick one of those, I'll pick child nutrition, that comes to us so that we can pay for meals at schools. And if that money didn't come to the state, we would have a choice of either not providing those or taking them out of the general fund that we provide to schools. Same with most of the rest of these programs here.
Okay. Just follow up, my overall view of this was there's about $900 million. Am I right? In the total operations, there's $700 or $800 million that federal funds you can't really touch. When you want to get down to it, there's about $36 million that's actually used for general funds for department operations. So when I looked at that budget, I was thinking, because the only way there's any potential, any savings in any of those programs is out of that $36 million. And that's basically operations of the Department of Education. And I know you've just gone through this reorganization, but my feel is, well, who says that's the right reorganization? Is there a better way to deliver the service? You know, I'm always harassing Vicki about, I want $20 million out of your budget.
Yeah.
Run this thing more efficiently, more some other way. But I only see out of this whole thing, there's only $36 million that we have to play with out of this whole thing. That's kind of how I look at it, out of the department operations, because the rest of it. But then, my question was, at some point, it seemed to me the testimony was the federal funds were an enhancement. They were not a standalone program. But from this, it sort of looks like they're standalone programs. And so I was just a little confused.
Yeah. Did you want to comment, Ms. Fleming? Or?
Senator Devlin, Senator Nelson, just briefly, I think I appreciate your comments, and that's a policy decision that we're here to make in partnership with you. It is very difficult on one hand to require more accountability in the system, and on the other hand to continue to erode the operational investment, and so I think that's really the question that we have before us when we get into the operational budget of the agency.
Just follow up on that.
Yes.
When I talk to my local folks out in an area, and I don't know how the operation of their things, and so I can't be critical of that, but when I talk to them, they say there are certain things that they really do rely upon the Department of Education for. Because certain things, you guys are just a pain in the neck. You just send out directives, and every 3 months you change it, or every 6 months, and so all of a sudden they're doing this, and they have to put people on this to answer all your questions, and that they're, I mean, in my sense, they'd like you to be more efficient. And they do appreciate a lot of the things that you do, you know. And I'll try and develop a list from some of those things. But there's some things that they just say. And I think the department has acknowledged that there's way too much reporting requirements. I talked to them about that and said, I thought the department was telling me they were changing. Well, they haven't seen the change on the field yet. So, I mean, those are just kind of my general comments and not really knowing how the whole thing works.
Chair Devlin and Senator Nelson, I can understand where someone who's in a very small school district in northeast corner of Oregon would feel that way about the request that they get from us for data and information. And I think we talked in phase one about the idea that we don't sit around and dream ideas up about information that we want to collect. When Senator Gordley asks questions about disaggregated subgroups of children who are of minority status or are low income so that we can make good decisions about where we invest our resources in the future, that requires my team to ask districts what is happening, in fact, with those subgroups of kids. So it's it is sort of the catch-22 in a regulatory and accountability venue, which the department largely is. In order to be accountable to the U.S. Department of Education and to you for the way the dollars get spent and the outcomes that are derived from those dollars, it does require us to collect information, analyze it, and be able to tell you whether or not we are, in fact, making progress. So I think that's the question before us. How much of an investment are you willing to make to continue to have that happen? And, in fact, if we're not able to do it because we've eroded the operational budget, what are the consequences that we would pay as an enterprise for that choice?
The operational budget for the department is about $90 million. About 50 or 55 of that is federal, and the rest of it is general. I mean, to me, it seems like $90 million to want to do this. It seems like it could be done a lot more efficiently. I might be wrong because I don't understand, but this seems like $90 million is a lot of money.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, you're absolutely right, and I would invite you to come to us with any ideas that you have about ways that we can be more efficient if you have them.
Well, my idea is that I should turn it over to you because you know how this thing operates. I say you operate this thing on $20 million less or $10 million less, and you make it happen because I don't have the expertise. I can't come in and say that, but if I was playing king here, I'd say, all right, you only have X amount of dollars. You make this thing run and run it as efficient as you possibly can, because I don't see how we're going to get into this whole thing with all the detail that you evidently do. And we're relying upon you to say, this is how we can get this done and do the job right. So. Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to open up the can of worms again, but I did say that I'd give you a brief description of the performance measures for each of these items. And so items 2 through 5, the performance measure is number 4, and that is the percentage of students in key subgroups achieving state standards for reading and math as a percentage of state average. And I won't go over each of them for the federal programs, but I did want to point out that it's my understanding the department in ranking the federal program started off with Title I-A because it is the primary NCLB program, and there's all that emphasis on those requirements under NCLB. And then the other programs were just ranked in descending dollar order.
Comments on, if there are any comments on, there are about 3 programs. Their numbers 20, 21, and there are actually two of the programs that were left off or were not funded, the Student Leadership Centers and the Frontier Learning Network. And I do note that the Frontier Learning Network, a small amount was listed for that actually in the budget, but the majority of the funds were cut. What does that mean? I mean, in terms of what's the impact of the cut of that program, and what is actually, is this just sort of a phase out? That's what the $64,000 is.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The $64,000 is another fund balance that we have left that I'm not sure at the moment sitting here exactly where it came from, but most of the funding was state funds, and by cutting that in the governor's budget, the program would be phased out. We would dispense of those other funds appropriately for the program, but it would probably phase out costs.
Okay. Well, what is the impact of that?
Senator Devlin, the impact is that many students will not receive course content that is delivered, in fact, by that distance technology and the programs that that area of the state have developed. I, in fact, have an email from a school administrator that outlines what will not be available in terms of courses to his high school students should that Frontier Learning Network disappear. This is a sort of unique program, and I know Senator Gordley knows a lot about this, that was developed in a small part of Oregon to really address access and equity to courses that were not available by the master schedule in each of those individual high schools, but in fact became a shared network of courses, and they've been very creative about developing curriculum and in fact have been on the fore of distance education in Oregon. The difficulty obviously for the department is that this is a program that serves only a portion of the state rather than the whole system, and so and the requirement of the 10% governor's cut really left us no choice.
Now, another clarification, Senator Gordon.
Go ahead. Are you still on the same?
Yeah. Can you provide us that letter? Can you provide the letter? Is it, do you think it's appropriate? The party would not object to the committee seeing what the impact would be. Senator Gordley, did you have a comment? Or?
Well, the comment was made that this is a program that only serves a part of the state and not the whole of the state. But I would ask, in removing the program, let me ask it differently. What other opportunities does the department see to put in place distance learning opportunities for students in rural communities in the absence of this particular effort, which was a model and a way of starting to provide a quality of education to students who are being underserved in rural communities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we see great opportunity in the area, the emerging area of distance education, and we would be very pleased to be able to talk to you about what we see as the preferred future. I think what we would want is everywhere in Oregon for students to have the access that, that has been created by the Frontier Learning Network. We have issued and awarded an RFP from the department for the design of a P16 e-learning delivery system that would include connections between high schools, K-12 institutions, community colleges, and universities as a way of doing business. And we have had discussions about a statewide virtual school that would allow resources to be connected from any school district in Oregon, including those post-secondary opportunities that you've heard some about in the conversations about Senate Bill 300 that would accelerate student learning and offer them the ability to move faster if they so choose to do that. That would require an investment in terms of program startup, and we believe it would be a very cost-effective investment to start a statewide virtual school, and we'll be talking to you some about that when we get to the conversation, I think, in the policy committees and perhaps hear about the e-learning task force that's in a piece of legislation that Senator Devlin is interested in. But very much believe from the department perspective and from the whole conversation and state board policy discussions about distance education being the technology that will bring us to the future that will increase access to more students for more rigorous course offerings.
It just sounds like there's a huge opportunity out there that will require an investment. How much of an investment? Is there a price tag on the program you're describing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, the very rough estimates for annual operation of a statewide virtual school that we've discussed with that alliance that's working on the RFP is somewhere between $750,000 and $1 million annually. Now, that's when you compare that to a bricks and mortar context, that's a very cost-effective way of delivering educational opportunities. We will have that RFP before the end of the legislative session. That design will be available. I hope maybe we can accelerate their deliverable on that if you're interested.
That estimate is very interesting. As I recall, the investment in the Frontier Learning Network that initial investment was somewhere around $750,000, wasn't it, or just under?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe, yes, it was around $750,000 plus or minus. It funded a lot of staff that actually were driving your trailer around the country and connecting with high school teachers on site.
So the opportunity you're describing really would be more bang for the buck, literally.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I believe so. I believe it's worthy of your consideration.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to recommend that we get more information about what's being described. And I'm ready to say that this is something that we should prioritize and recommend. The benefit is certainly going to be to students all over the state and students who are currently underserved in their communities.
I would agree, Senator Gordley, but I think one of the items I would like to ask doesn't mean it couldn't be funded, but neither program is funded in the governor's budget, are they?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Oh, I clearly understand that. I'm saying let's find the $750,000 to $100 million to $1 million annually that it would cost.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
March, then Representative Wisman.
The Frontier Learning Network's a very interesting and I think, you know, productive. But in terms of balance, this sounds like a opportunity for us to serve a greater number of students for about twice the amount of money. But one thing that I'm not clear on in the Frontier Learning Network is to what extent are the local ESDs and school districts supporting the Frontier Learning Network in terms of costs, and how many students are we serving with that Frontier Learning Network? And if we could get that kind of information and then compare it with the information on the virtual school concept to see where our bang for the buck is going to work, I'd really appreciate that.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's for you or Sue, probably Sue. The top items that we've gone through here, the first nine, there's no FTEs for ODE. Now, are they passing that out without any staff or anything on that? And second question is on the educating children with disabilities, we were told that that's ESD, but we give ESDs $250 million out of the school fund. So how does this $30 million in ESD's budget, how does that reconcile?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wisman, these are grant and aid programs, and therefore the monies are completely passed through the department's budget. The associated staff work and the FTE you would see on page 2, although there's not a clear link the way that these are listed, but the activities that the staff carry out to administer the programs and grant management, things like that, you would see in these various accountability and so on, those line items. So the ones on the front page are just the dollars that go out to the local programs. And then, the dollars that go out to any of the ESDs that provide services in through these grant and aid programs, those dollars are on top of what they get through the state school fund.
Mm. I didn't know that. Is OD, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there any admin charge held by ODE for any of these pass-throughs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, as Sue said, the admin charges show up in the other department operations portion of the budget. What you see here is generally 95% of the total that comes in for each one of these programs. That's kind of a rule of thumb. Most federal programs allow us to use 5% for administration, and that shows up in the other areas that we'll be talking about with our operational budget.
So
far from this, from here, we don't fund any positions out of this grant and aid budget item.
So for clarification, that 5% actually makes up, I can't remember the exact number, but you have of your $90 million in operations, roughly somewhere over $40 million of it is federal funds. And that's probably the largest share is that 5% wouldn't.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I think another important thing to talk about as part of that 5% is that from those federal funds, we can only administer those federal programs that the 5% comes from. So for special ed programs, we can't use those funds to administer any other Title I programs or child nutrition. There's those kind of barriers around them or firewalls.
Okay. Can comment on the connectivity program?
Mr. Chair, originally this was the open grant and aid program, the Oregon Public Education Network program, and that's a statewide technology project that helps the K-12 schools participate in a coordinated information network and distance learning. It was funded at about $2.3 million a couple of biennia ago, and then it was reduced during the special session. And this biennium, I think it received $800,000, and so this is another reduction from the funding that it's received. I would ask the department to speak to it because the name is now changed to Connectivity Grants, and so I'm not sure if it's actually still with the open program or if it's morphed into something.
Did you want to talk to that?
Mr. Chair, I can start first with that. We did propose that the entire $800,000 amount be cut as part of the governor's budget so that we could take that before we got to the Oregon pre-kindergarten program reductions that we had to recommend. The connectivity piece that's left here is intended only for making sure that districts and schools have the capacity they need to connect with backbones and other technical infrastructure. And Doug Kosky here is way smarter about that part of it than I am.
Yeah. Senator Devlin, members of the committee, specifically the connectivity budget is intended to balance or equalize the cost of connections for those communities in rural Oregon and kind of offset it against the more urban areas. There's a disparate share of disparate cost for providing that type of service. Currently, the Oregon Public Education Network has been facilitating that work.
Another program, SMART, which I think most of us are aware of what it stands for. The $100,000 that the State General Fund, which is a grant basically to that program, do we know how much that makes up of their annual budget? Or
Mr. Chair, no, we don't. To be quite honest, we hadn't included that in our budget, and the governor added that back at the same level that we had for the current biennium. Okay. I don't know what percentage that makes up of the overall activity in the state.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Now, that was one of the things that I flagged. I mean, I don't know what you can do for 100,000, 100, you know, how many schools, 1,200 schools we have, and how many elementary, because, I mean, all of us, our school districts is an important program we want, but it's, I think it's all done locally and through some Commission on Children and Family grants and county grants that we support that program. I'm just not sure what we're doing with 100,000 in the state. It's a little bit, but a couple hundred thousand here and a couple hundred thousand there. We can help put money in programs that are really important. Desperate need.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, we've pretty much passed that money through, and I would guess without knowing for certain that that probably supports a lot of their media efforts and the recruitment of volunteers to actually participate in that program, but we can certainly find out exactly what that buys.
I'm not against the program.
No. Neither is the chair. I just think we may need some more explanation in phase two just to see. Yes, Representative Whitson. Or Senator Whitson, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, would it be possible to get the Department of Education to give this committee a breakdown of this, the sources of these funds, not only just from general fund or lottery fund, but also the federal source, the other source, and then a brief description of the constraints with which they can use those other sources and those federal sources. And then we could study that and then have a little more meaningful conversation.
I think it would be clearly possible to do that, and probably during phase two, which phase two for them is not very long from now. It's actually only a couple of weeks away, actually.
I'm sure that they know that and where these sources and constraints are. And if we knew that ahead of time, we could perhaps be able to have a better conversation.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm looking in our notebook on this budget, and there is some delineation there of general fund, lottery fund, other funds, federal funds, and non-limited.
There is. The only reason they're not on your sheets is we could only include so much in one spreadsheet. And so,
Mr. Chair, also, if I may, Senator Wisnick, in the binders that we handed out during phase one, there's an entire section on federal funds that talks about the source of funds for all programs, the uses for each one of those programs, and kind of the parameters around which we can use them. It also talks about whether or not there are maintenance of effort requirements or planning and supplementing issues. Yeah. And so in the blue binders that we handed out.
I realize, and I have looked through those, you probably also realize that this is one of about a dozen of these that we received this year. And I was wondering if we could just get that in a brief bullet form on a page or two or three, where we wouldn't have to dig through, for instance, in this meeting here today, we don't have all of our different three-ring notebooks with us, so it would be, I think it would be useful to have that condensed down to where we could refer to it.
Okay. We will work on that for the phase two. The next area is kind of an area that all fits, well, actually I left out one from before. One other item that was requested that we look at it by some members from outside the committee, I think at least one inside the committee, was the student leadership centers, which were cut in the governor's budget. Could we get a brief explanation for what those are?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Salam Noor is assistant superintendent and manages the Carl Perkins Professional Technical Education Investments, and the Student Leadership Center is a requirement, an activity for leadership that's required under that act, so he can tell you about that.
Can I get a clarification on that, and then perhaps he can answer that. If that is required as part of that act, and I know there's some question about the future of Perkins funds, but how are we going to meet that requirement if we're not funding the leadership element?
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Salam Noor from the Office of Education Improvement and Innovation. The Student Leadership Development Center is really grant and aid dollars that flow through the organization in the form of a contract. Currently, it's with the Willamette Education Service District that supports seven organizations. Some, many of you may be familiar with those, the FFA, FBLA, DECA, HOSA. And they currently serve approximately 1,200 students throughout the state. And they work with students on career development activities, leadership activities to enhance their academic performance and their technical skill attainments relative to these specific areas. They also support state competitions, and many of our students have been extremely successful, and they have participated in national competitions specifically relative to FFA. And I understand one of our local area schools, as you probably have read in the morning, this morning will probably go to a national competition for DECA. The Perkins Act allows us to use some of those funds to support student leadership development activities, and we use a portion of our funds to actually supplement the funds that the state provides for student leadership development. And currently, the Perkins Act is up for reauthorization, and the President and the U.S. Department of Education has proposed that Perkins actually be eliminated and those funds be provided to states under a formula block grant, if you will, to support high school reform. And it's we're actually conflicted about that because that's the only source of funding that's devoted to vocational and technical education at this nationally and at the state level. So we are working with our delegation in Washington, D.C. to monitor the progress of deliberations there to determine the future or the fate of Perkins, if you will. But it's a very valuable source of funding that we use to support career and technical education programs in our state. And we use some of those funds to support the student leadership programs.
It's my understanding that Congress is smacking the President around a little bit on that. I don't think Congress will acquiesce to his request. I've read just in recent days that they're adding it back into the budget. So, but it's still up in the air.
Is that the normal process that we've went through in a lot of programs, which is commonly referred to as devolution, where they give us slightly less money. They say that the compensation for that is we get more flexibility, and then they keep the same requirements. Would that be would that be a fair analysis of it?
Chair Devlin, I believe you are absolutely right. That's a very accurate analysis of the situation we currently face. Perkins provides us approximately $30 million per biennium, and if we were to receive funds to support high school reform in our state, we would see a reduction of approximately $20 million, because what we're anticipated to receive at this time is $5 million a year, and that will not even begin to scratch the surface relative to all the work that needs to happen at the high school level especially.
Okay. Yes, Representative Gordon.
Mr. Chair, in past sessions, I'm just reminded that some of the most exciting, really outstanding testimony has come from young people participating in these programs. I can recall sitting in a hearing room with the chairs full of students and their enthusiasm. And recalling that just reminds me how awkward this process feels, in that we are talking about programs in the absence of having heard public testimony. We're going to get to that. But again, this is just a commentary, an editorial comment, if you will, on the process. It just seems a little out of order for those of us who have participated in the past and who have that recall. We can put this information together, but in the absence of that history and continuity, this is a difficult exercise.
Thank
you
very
much.
Yeah. Just a question. If there's Perkins money goes into student leadership centers, and that either because the act doesn't come about or because of a change in the direction that it's going to take, if that takes that Perkins money out of the student leadership centers, it leaves us in the budget with 736, if this is included, 1,000. And my sense of what you're saying is that's probably a waste of money. That will not do anything in relationship to the student learning centers, for the student learning centers.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, if I may clarify, we use a small portion of our Perkins funds to supplement the state funds. Perkins is intended specifically to support programs in schools and community colleges throughout the state. So the law allows us to use a portion of funds to support and supplement activities at the state level. But if we were to take federal funds and use those in place of general funds, that would actually be considered supplanting, and it would be a violation of Perkins law. And I think it's important for the committee to be aware of the maintenance of efforts and match requirements that are stipulated in the Perkins legislation.
Is this another item that was offered by the department and where the governor chose to take the item?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think maybe, I'm not sure I know exactly what you're asking, but
that wasn't my answer.
The general fund investment allows the student leadership activities to be coordinated at the state level so that the competitions and support, if there is no longer a state investment, it leaves those organizations to try to support their activities from a very grassroots approach. And so the advantage of the Student Leadership Center was that they had a coordinated state staff infrastructure that allowed events to take place, competitions, conferences to be coordinated, communication with the Department of Education in a way that supported their efforts statewide. So the elimination of that then leaves them to their own devices locally to coordinate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Maybe somebody could give us a breakdown of all of flow of that money.
Yeah. We will during phase two. Representative Mark.
Thank you. Just to clarify, you're talking about the Perkins grant money. In which line item in your budget does that appear? Because the only Perkins that I see standing out alone is in the Community College and Workforce Development. And I may just look by it in all the lines.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, in our priority sheets, if you look at item number 11 overall, it's the vocational education grant programs.
Okay. Thank you.
Those are Perkins dollars?
Perkins plus others, I would think.
Plus others?
Yeah, because there's $110 million there, and they indicated there was about $30 million in Perkins funds.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I can't remember what the answer to your question was on Friday as to whether we need to rank these programs that have just federal money.
The answer was yes. And the reason is not because that was necessarily the chair's wishes or the committee's wishes. That was the co-chair's wishes.
Oh. Okay. Thank you for that explanation.
One thing I might comment on this program, the Student Leadership Centers, and one thing that was pointed out to me by several other parties, is that this is another example of one of those items that provides some connectivity to students at the high school level, something to keep them basically connected to their high school, just as athletics might, this might, theater, arts, music might, but we tend to be taking many of those items away from the high school level, and then we wonder why we have problems with graduation levels of students staying in school and staying interested. If you might want to comment.
Mr. Chair, I definitely would like to affirm that statement, and I'll tell you from my own experience that my two children graduated from Perrydale High School, where 80%+ of the student population is a member of the FFA club, and it is not just about ag science or agriculture education. It is, in fact, about civics and community values and community service and the food drives and the conservation projects and a variety of things that they do, and, in fact, is the center of the community's value system. And I believe in many of your districts that your geography is represented by, that is the case, and that is an activity, a set of activities and a set of values that we would like to see sustained in Oregon.
The next items on the agenda are basically the Oregon School for the Deaf, the Oregon School for the Blind, youth corrections, education programs, and juvenile detention education programs. Now, my understanding of those, and I may be wrong, is in the case of the Oregon School for the Deaf, and the Oregon School for the Blind, they are basically within your budget, the youth corrections programs, although they show up here as not a general fund expenditure, they are in effect part of the state school fund, and it's simply because they are part of the state school fund and that money comes back that they are showing up not as a general fund expenditure. In reality, they are a general fund expenditure. Did any committee members want any explanation or have any comments on those? I don't think there's really a choice. Their level of funding might be a choice, but... Okay. One question for the committee. In regards to numbers 7 through 18, which are largely... either federal funds, other funds, with the only minor exception of the $50,000 in the child nutrition. In our attempt to put some committee priority order in those items, does anybody have an objection to wherever those fit in, that they fit in as a block? Understanding the explanation that you gave, that you basically looked at your Title I requirements first, which are your basic requirements, and then just listed them after that in order. Does any committee member have an objection if we attempt to give a priority listing that we just do those? We'll list them in priorities, but they will fit into as a block. What I'm trying to say by that is we're not going to try to differentiate between them. They're virtually all federally funded. We're not going to turn down $800 or $900 million that is a clear benefit to students in Oregon. So is there any objection to that?
No, but I just have one question.
Yeah.
And it's the child nutrition program.
Yes.
Because I don't like our school lunches.
Yeah. You have bills for that.
Yeah. Well, there's bills about junk food, and I really don't like those bills, but I'm giving them a hearing anyway, because I think we ought to target the school lunches. But I don't think we have any control over how those lunches are made. And I was looking back here on testimony on February 3rd, and I asked about that. And Representative Wisman asked some questions about the school lunches, and we have, the answer was three positions lead the entire early childhood education program, mostly funded with federal dollars, not nutritionists. There was a whole discussion about nutritionists and how much we're spending on food. What I just need an explanation of what this $50 million does, and do we have any say over what the federal government tells us to feed our kids? Because some districts actually have wholesome food. Others have chocolate milk and pizza and chicken nuggets and basically salt, fat, and crap. So...
You might want to comment.
To put it bluntly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pat Burke is here, and he's been serving on a food task force and probably has deeper knowledge than I do. I can tell you that the federal government, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, does set certain standards that we have to make sure that the districts live by, but there are some other issues that will probably be before your committee soon, and I would let Pat comment.
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, there are two key factors. One is whether or not a local district seeks reimbursement from the federal school lunch and breakfast program. Not all districts do that. So if a district is running its own food service program outside of federal reimbursement, you may find some of those practices. And that is largely a question of cost effectiveness. For schools that use the federal funding and meal reimbursement, they must comply with federal nutrition guidelines, and those guidelines actually are in the process of being revamped. By June of 2006, every district that receives federal funding must have in place a local wellness policy developed and approved by its local school board that addresses things such as nutrition, the requirements for meals in terms of things such as sugar, fat content, and calories, and serving sizes. And then there is currently under development a set of Oregon nutrition guidelines that would be in place as well. Those as yet have not been approved and would ultimately, the State Board of Education is authorized under federal law to establish those guidelines. So there's the key factor, key answer to your question is whether or not a district seeks federal reimbursement for meals. If it participates in that program, then the meal itself must meet the federal guidelines, and the districts receive reimbursement on a per meal served basis. And each meal served must meet the nutrition guidelines established by the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And, Mr. Chair, a follow-up to that, if a district opts out of getting reimbursed by the federal government, where do they get the money to pay for their food service program?
It would come out of their general fund and mostly out of whatever they charge students on a per-meal basis.
So my question is, why would a district do that?
Some people find it difficult to comply with federal regulations, especially a small or more rural school. We certainly encourage districts to participate in the program. We think it is a financial benefit to them as well as a nutritional benefit to children.
Okay. And then can you please explain to me what the $50 million does? Because my notes from February 3rd don't really give me any indication. Oh,
$50,000.
I'm sorry.
$50,000.
Yeah. That would be a lot of money.
The summer lunch program. Okay.
That would be a whole lot of money. Thank you.
The summer lunch program allowed us to expand the number of meals served in summer feeding sites.
Oh, okay.
Actually, Lane County, Food for Lane County received an award recently and was featured in the promotion of that activity. We are trying to expand these sites in collaboration with the governor's anti-hunger program. This is a real cost benefit to districts to be able, and park bureaus and other sites during the summer, to bring federal reimbursed meals to children during the summer.
So that's all that $50,000 does, and I got that right this time, is just for the summer lunch program?
That's correct, and it's a match against additional federal dollars.
Oh, okay. Well, and I think I had a bill in my policy committee that we sent to Ways and Means on expanding the summer lunch program.
Yes, you do, sir.
It's a great program. All right, well, that clears that up for me. I still would like you to lobby Congress and get better meals, and I'll look at those nutrition guidelines when they come out in June. But they're awful.
Senator Walker, we share your concern. We have just completed a six-month task force on this issue. We have 33 recommendations that will go before the State Board in April about improving nutrition and educational programs around health, wellness, and nutrition for students. But I would say probably the thing that's going to be one of the major factors in the near future is districts and their local boards working on coming into compliance with the new federal regulations.
Mr. Chair, if I could just get a parting shot. When we have the hearing on the junk food bills, as we call them, I hope you come in and talk about the new nutrition guidelines and what we can do other than banning vending machines and those kinds of things.
We intend to be there.
All right, thank you.
Just to give the committee an update, we are about a half an hour left today. We are going to come back tomorrow to the Oregon Department of Education to finish up. It will still be going on the next 20 to 30 minutes. And then we will be getting into the state school fund for the latter portion of our discussions tomorrow. I might make a suggestion on the state school fund. There are 18 items in the state school fund in terms of how they're broken out. About, depending upon your viewpoint, anywhere from about 6 to 9 of them relate clearly to just the issue of instruction. We can probably debate those tomorrow and see if it's 6, 7, 8, or 9, but I might suggest to the committee that those areas we might want to forward to the chairs as basically 1A through 1H, because I do not believe that the committee, we could have a very, very long discussion, but I do not believe the committee is going to settle on a priority of grades K through 3 over 4 through 5 or middle school over high school, and I don't think it's actually a debate that is probably going to get us anywhere. I think we'll probably get much more when we're debating the other nine items, which relate to central administration, school administration, support services for schools, transportation services for schools. Those are probably the items that are probably worthy to debate, some of those just being just as essential in terms of being able to educate children. But I don't think we're going to get anywhere debating the relative importance of third grade versus fifth grade. And I will take the heat from the co-chairs if the committee is okay with that. So we will debate primarily the other nine items.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The one item that we wanted additional clarification on was the category of all other expenditures. That was the one that...
Right. That is... We see that actually in a lot of the budgets. Actually, we don't... We have a central operations in the Department of Ed budget. Maybe that's all other expenditures, but in practically every other budget we have an all other expenditures, and in one of the agencies I think that's about $1.2 billion. So, Department
of Higher Ed. I wish I had a category in my home budget for all other expenditures.
We're now on to the issues around the core operations of the Department of Ed, which is probably where we're going to be today, and where we're going to be the first 30-45 minutes tomorrow. That gets to this handout, basically. One of the items I might want to highlight here and see if there's a committee reaction, and I actually probably should get some comments from the Department of Ed. The integrated data system is an element that is in the Department of Ed's budget, the community college budget, and higher ed's budget. And it basically goes to being able to follow the progress of individual students through their educational life, rather than simply testing third grade students and fifth grade students, which we will still do, but we don't really know if the if a particular third grade student is doing better in fifth grade, or if a student that was doing well in fifth grade is now doing poorly in eighth grade. We only know aggregates. So if Ms. Fleming might want to comment on that, because it'll be an issue in every one of our budgets.
Senator Devlin, you're absolutely right. This is one of the most important investments I think that Oregon can make in order to know what its educational outcomes really are through the entire pre-K through 20 educational system. Doug can speak specifically to the investment that we're asking for at this phase of the development of the integrated data system.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services. There are two components, actually, of the integrated data system budget that are reflected in the agency's request. One is, for lack of a better word, a consolidation of data centers within the K-12 enterprise. The other component is that integration of data and information on students as children move from pre-K through elementary, high school, and onto their post-secondary travels. The movement of that information currently can be best summed up as a paper chase. It's essentially a paper document that is moved from one entity to another. And the intent of this is to actually integrate the enterprises of pre-K-12 community colleges and the university systems so that we truly look at the enterprise of education as a whole from a systems perspective.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that Senator Nelson isn't here to hear this, but I think in terms of efficiencies and ways that we can invest in becoming more efficient, this is one of the primary ways that that can happen.
One follow-up I would have, is this going to help? I know that you've been working in this area. In some school districts in some states, when they take tests similar to our assessments, like in the fifth grade, teachers might get those results back 4 months later on what the students' results were. That's hardly helpful in terms of addressing that student's individual's needs. And while I mean, I think some people in grade school might particularly say that a teacher should be able to get indications of those, if it's an eighth grade test and it's in mathematics, an average math teacher might have 150 or 180 students in a day. So I just wonder if you'd comment where we are at in that progress in terms of being able to get feedback to teachers on test scores on a very timely basis.
Chair Devlin, we are making great strides along that area. The advent of TESA has sped up the flow of information back to the individual teachers. So that's one way that information gets back to the classroom. The individual student reports and the class rosters and group reports that you referred to in the past have been paper-based. This integrated data system, while it will make positive impacts on that process, we're attempting through the Office of Assessment to address putting that information out on a web-based format so that the kid or the teachers actually have access to it sooner rather than later. And when we recognize the length of time that it takes to get that information into the hands of the kids. What the integrated data system would allow, though, for is when a child moves from one district to another district, barring any complications with privacy issues through the Federal Education Rights to Privacy Act, FERPA, it would allow the exchange of data through a transcript mechanism, electronic transcript mechanism. That, I think, in addition to the assessment data, would be huge for the individual classroom teachers.
Okay. We will move on now to some of the other areas. We have a draft explanation of some of the other areas in the Department of Ed, which I thought would be helpful to some committee members, not only during this week, but actually during phase two, and we'll get more there. Are there particular areas where the committee has concerns or where they would like further explanation?
Chair, I'm not sure I understood the question.
Okay. We still have items 24 through 32, and I might add a 33, central operations. Mm-hmm. Are there particular areas where the committee would like either to comment or some need for some further elaboration on what those areas actually are? I'll start it off. Assessment.
I have a couple.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Assessment. We see that is about half and half. I assume that's about half state dollars and half federal dollars. How much of those assessment activities are actually required either as part of No Child Left Behind or part of our own education reform efforts?
Chair Devlin, members of the committees, a majority of those activities are specific to No Child Left Behind requirements and state report card. There are optional activities, and I use the term optional a little bit loosely in terms of social sciences and Spanish reading. While they're not specifically required, they are allowed by No Child Left Behind, specifically Spanish reading, to be used to assess the learning of, or the level of learning of a Spanish reading student.
To what degree, how would you answer the question if we were to, and I'm not advocating this, but if we were to just, in a sense, back up to No Child Left Behind and drop our own requirements and basically follow just their requirements? To what degree might there be an impact on this particular budget item in terms of assessment?
I think there would, or Chair Devlin, I believe there would be some impact, but I would have to get back and look at the numbers. Okay. As you're probably well aware, we did an in-depth analysis for house audits as a discovery or fact-finding of the cost of assessments, and I could look at that in a different light.
Well, Representative Jensen's going to bail me out now for some additional questions.
Well, I guess I'd have kind of the same thing with closing the achievement gap. I wind up with a question mark on my assessment or on my rating of this.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Jensen, maybe it would help to kind of refresh the reasons why you see these words before you, and they're related to the reorganization of the department. What we had 2 years ago was a department that was largely organized around federal grant streams and programs. It did not necessarily talk between offices very effectively. And so as we went through our reorganization, that one of the objectives was to become, over time, more and more integrated in our approach, so that if we create processes for school districts to demonstrate accountability and to demonstrate what the outcomes are that they're achieving, that they're not different processes for special education versus professional technical education versus No Child Left Behind, but in fact we're thinking about, in general, what continuous improvement looks like and talking to one another in the agency about how we ask districts to do that. So the closing the achievement gap is, in fact, a priority. A leadership priority of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and the activities that are really reflected there in that particular line item are activities that the agency is engaged in to support district efforts in closing the achievement gap. So you can see the explanation on your spreadsheet, which is really about looking at the research, looking at teaching and learning, being able to disseminate information and provide professional development for teachers about what that means, and then also looking at our content standards, looking at special populations of students now that we have additional breakouts of data. What is it that English language learners need? What is it that teachers need to support English language learners in the classroom? So a variety of activities like that.
Some follow-up.
Well, let's see, there must be some $2 plus million federal money or something there. What's the rationale of the federal dollars on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that would represent some of the funds that come to us for under No Child Left Behind, and the specific purpose of which is to make sure that every student is succeeding and, in fact, supporting some of the same efforts that I just described earlier, the mix of general and federal fund investments. So much of our staff is funded with federal funds at this point, and so that would largely be an investment in staff.
Is there a maintenance of effort type of thing with this category, or if we wiped out 800,000, would we still get the 2.2? I guess is kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, I'll let Brett speak to the maintenance of effort question. I think what you see represented in the column that's general fund in all of these activities is, in fact, the staff and the time and the resources that are about implementing Oregon's vision for its educational system. We are largely funded with federal funds and are supported in our implementation of state mandates with federal funds at this point. If you begin to look at those line items in the general fund investments, much of the leadership and the implementation of Oregon's mandates would be severely limited.
Any additional follow-up? Senator Nelson, then Senator Gordley, then Representative Wisnett.
Going back to what we were talking with Doug and his department, Assessment and Information Service, I'm looking at the organizational chart in this big book here. It's sort of the next the last three or four pages. He's got three departments that he's really looking overlooking. I have 14 employees in one, 22 in another, and 25 in a third, just looking at this. Of those, there's five of those, there's vacant positions. Now, are we funding those vacant positions in this budget? Is that part of the budget?
My understanding, and maybe it's Sue's comment, is the vacant positions are still in the governor's budget because they're being shown.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, as you know, last session we took a hard look at vacant positions and eliminated some and allowed agencies to keep others if they met certain criteria, and I am assuming that there will be a similar look this session. By your legislative fiscal office.
My theory is the only place we're going to find any savings in this whole budget of this $900 million is in this organizational chart. By my count, there's 26 vacant positions in all these departments. And I'm just saying, assuming on a biennial basis, that's $100,000 a position, there's $2.6 million. I mean, I'm 10% of the way there, Vicki. I'm working on it. I'll keep working. But it, to me, is these vacant positions, they're part of the budget. I mean, they're getting the job done. They still have 26 vacant positions. We could save, we could cut those out of the budget. There's, if you assume $100,000 on a biannual basis, that's $2.6 million. I mean, that's what I think we have to be looking for in this thing.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think that's an important point you make, Senator Nelson. I think another thing to keep in mind about this org chart, it's a snapshot in time, and it was done on November 9th as the last time that we made any major organizational changes to the org chart. So we may or may not have those specific positions still being vacant, and you're correct, the work did continue to get done. A lot of times that was at the expense of some of Doug's staff actually staying overnight to get the Oregon report card out. So it does put a strain having all those vacant positions on us.
In this time of great unemployment, you can't fill them. To me it doesn't make any sense. But
Senator Nelson, for clarification, I do think that the vacant positions will get some considerable review in phase two, and I think the co-chairs have expressed some interest in having just as much scrutiny on vacant positions this session as there was last session. So some of those will probably be continued. Some of them may not, actually. So.
Well, there's 26 then, exactly.
Yeah.
As I go through all of this.
Is that it? Senator Cordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you walk us through what's included in central operations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I can. On the original spreadsheet we gave you back in your blue binders, the second page of the priority list shows you that in central operations we have the core functions such as accounting, budgeting, internal personnel, a lot of the state school fund administration, which is just getting the dollars out the door. Information technology is another big area, so a big part of Doug's shop, as we were just talking about, shows up there as well.
This is the standard question that you will hear. So when you said accounting, personnel, information technology, I would guess, except for rent and a few other items, these would be the same items that the Department of Administrative Services would cite for their service charges to your agency. And to what extent is this functions that have to be performed on the agency level versus by the Department of Administrative Services?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good question. The Department of Administrative Services probably could do a lot of those accounting or personnel functions for us. They would still need the people to do those. I don't know what their workloads are, so I can't tell you whether they would need more or less.
Yeah.
I think it's a fair enough question that I cannot answer for you, I'm afraid.
Representative Wisnett.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the comments you just made and Senator Gorley made relate to some of my questions about the central operation. Because we're, you know, I'm looking at a percentage of the overall budget, and that's pretty high. The other question I had, Ms. Fleming, was these terms, closing the achievement gap, middle school, high school improvement, ready for school, each school, is that, did we create those terms or those federal terms? Or, and, you know, like the governor's been off to this conference, I watched a little bit on C-SPAN, so I guess we're going to have another program come in, and is that going to replace one of these, or is that going to be another one we're going to have to fund? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, very good questions. The descriptors that you see for the general fund investment in the Oregon Department of Education are largely related to us moving in our evolution to the same way of managing our work that you are talking about here in the legislature, which is if, in fact, you wish to close the achievement gap, you ought to be aligning your resources, both human and fiscal, toward those priorities. So when we did our reorganization, it was largely about understanding that Superintendent Castillo had a certain set of priorities, and we had a certain set of things that we have to do by law and by leadership and policy agenda, and that we have organized our budget around those that mission. So no, those are not things that you created. In fact, they are things that we created under the leadership of the elected superintendent of public instruction. The idea here is that we begin to identify in a leadership context what things, what the data tells us we ought to be paying attention to and what we ought to be investing in to address student success in a more effective fashion. So in regard to the National Governors Association Summit on High Schools, we, in fact, would leverage that opportunity and any additional funding that would be available to us in Oregon to address middle and high school improvement in general, and it would be not something that we would see as being new, but additional, perhaps, resources and attention to a set of priorities that we've already identified.
Thank you. One follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you for those comments, Ms. Fleming. The leadership... That's a big cost, and again, I'm having trouble, and I guess as we get into more detail, but leadership and central operations, that's, you know, put those together, and we're talking about a lot of money. Maybe we can talk when we see the flow charts and the organizational charts. I went through and highlighted a lot of the verbs, identify, conduct, develop, and all that. I think I've talked to a superintendent. I don't know, you and I talked about this, but I really am... As a newcomer down here, I'm looking for leadership, and I don't see that, you know, really expressed or highlighted. Like, I think that collecting and validating the data for the state school fund, that's a clerk job. I mean, I'd like to see some, you know, review, validate, update, you know, 14-year-old process that determines how our money is being distributed has never been changed, and so I would still look for leadership from the superintendent and ODE to some things like that. We should, you've got some of your verbs are develop and implement, but leadership and thinking outside the box, we have to look at performance measures, but an update. So that's, I guess, editorial comments, except the leadership, if you want to talk about that. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, would you like us to talk about that now, or would you like us to talk about that more when we get into our phase
does
two?
Does it overlap, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Does it overlap with central ops, or is that we're going to see that? You can explain. We see the flow charts or the organizational charts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, practically everything on this list overlaps with something else, which speaks to the idea that we're trying to be more integrated in our approach and develop a more effective organization. The fact that we have constructed a budget that is allocated around the superintendent's priorities is a pretty significant leadership statement. Superintendent Castillo has said that closing the achievement gap is her number one priority, which has led us to a lot of activities that we're engaged in, which are about redesigning our accountability system. How do we know, in fact, that with the data and information that we have, that we're getting it back to districts so that they can act upon it and designing processes that help them, in fact, get better at what they do? That would be something that would be under the accountability line item. The assessment line item, we can't give districts back information unless you have some idea of what student achievement looks like by virtue of having tested it, teaching and learning, and processing that information. One of the activities that's listed under the leadership category, as you said, is about conducting policy research and analysis. We recognize that we are data rich and information poor, and the capacity of our agency to do that analysis effectively and give it back to school districts has been very limited, and we are making that transition now to build that capacity over time, to move from less of a program management approach and more of a research and analysis approach. We have many very qualified and talented people at the department. They may not necessarily represent the skill set for analyzing data and giving it back to districts in a way that is meaningful and relevant to them to act upon, and that is a capacity I think that is probably our number one issue.
Representative Mark, could you save your question for tomorrow morning?
Mm-hmm.
At this particular point, we will be adjourning. We will come back tomorrow morning. We will still be on items in general between 24 and 32. And for those members, I know that Representative Wisnett has turned his in, but then's taken it back. But for those members that have not turned in their pages for the Oregon Department of Education and the State School Fund, could they please bring them tomorrow morning? That's this kind of.
Do you have names on these?
I don't actually have to have names.
Okay.
I'm not actually planning on sharing them with anybody other than me and Ms. McGlashan. So it kind of helps us to.
I hope those turning them in tomorrow get graded down.
Yeah. But I'm not planning on. What we will try to do is to come up with the co-chairs actually want a ranking order for all of these items. And what we will attempt to do is to take all of your comments, your relative markings on these sheets, and then come up with a ranking order to present to the co-chairs. And what we're intending to do is to have the discussion tomorrow on the rest of the Oregon Department of Education, the State School Fund. Then we will work on a ranking and bring it back to you probably on Wednesday. And then on Wednesday we will also be going to community colleges and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and then higher education and OHSU on Thursday. Keeping in mind that if something is ranked 9th and you think it should be ranked 7th, that isn't probably a big deal. If you think it should be ranked 7th and it's ranked 21st, that's probably a big deal. And so we will in general try to reflect as much as we can. In terms of the rankings from 1 to 5, I think we will look at those in a relative level. I've always noticed that people tend to mark in certain ways, so we look at their relative level of how they mark things, not necessarily just a 1. A lot of people will mark things just 1, 2, 3. They won't go to 4 and 5. Some will mark all the way from 1 to 5. So we're just looking at the relative level that they mark items. With that, Representative Jensen.
Am I clear, Mr. Chair, that you merely want the Department of Education and State School Funds now? Or do you want all?
I could use them all because the task is really huge for Ms. McGlashan and Mr. Bender for the rest of this week. And the more information we have, the earlier we have, it's probably the easier for them. So if you had it all tomorrow morning, that would be very beneficial. But at a minimum, please have the Oregon Department of Education and State
School. We have the Oregon Department of Education completed.
Yeah.
The other above, we don't have.
Okay.
Right?
Okay. Bring what you do have tomorrow morning.
I can, with a little patience, so I can transpose this to another sheet.
Yes,
I can give those to you this morning.
That would be fine.
Okay.
My question actually was not for the department, but for our folks. What other statewide elected independent officials use DAS for their administrative stuff, which was one of the kind of the questions that seemed that kind of focused towards
Actually, most of them do have DAS charges.
I don't think anybody escapes the tentacles.
But in terms of having some more of their functions, and was the thrust of the question. So if you can check that out. Thanks.
Okay. With that, I'll close the hearing, and we are adjourned for tomorrow morning at 8:30.